The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in his Washington Times Community column, Forbidden Siegel Talk.
It's time now for The Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
Good evening. This is Mike Friedenberg filling in for Bob Siegel on The Bob Siegel Show. Thank you for joining us this evening. I think we have some interesting topics lined up for you this evening. And Bob's out enjoying himself, so I was very honored to be asked to sit in for him. A little bit about myself. I am... been very active in politics for quite a few decades, written for local publications such as the Union Tribune, the Daily Transcript, California Political Review, National Review Magazine, and also was the founding president of a local political organization known as the Adam Smith Institute. So probably a little bit more of a political bent on this. Well, I don't know if that's true, but I'm not a full-time evangelist and apologist like Bob, but I'm certainly, if somebody wants to call in and talk about the Bible or Christianity, I certainly would love to engage them. But I'm going to start off this evening talking about, just giving a little bit of talk about some of the debates that Bob's been involved with in the last few weeks and months and, frankly, years. And recently he has debated some Muslims. And I've seen these debates, gone through them and watched replays of them. And just a little comment on it I'd like to make is that it's interesting when you watch these debates. It's you're almost talking about apples and oranges when let's say a Muslim, a devout Muslim, talks about the Quran and when a Christian talks about the Bible. And what I mean by that is when the Muslim talks about the word of the book, They are literally talking about literally the word of God. Their belief is that over a period of 23 years that Muhammad directly transcribed, well, actually he didn't transcribe them. He had people transcribe what he verbally told them to transcribe, the words of the Quran. So literally, word for word, really it's not necessarily supposed to exhibit his personality or, you know, anything like that. This was God saying, okay, take this down, Muhammad, and this is what I want you to write. Now, there is places in the Bible, and particularly in the Old Testament, where that happens as well. Moses and the Ten Commandments, for example, would be an example of Moses directly transcribing down the commandments from God. But the vast majority of the Bible is not like that. And I feel that when the subject's debated between Christians and Muslims, that there's sometimes that's not established at the very beginning how we look at things. And part of it may be the nomenclature and our terminology, because we say the word of God, and Muslims, you know, believe that the Quran's the word of God. But when we say the word of God as Christians, we actually are speaking a little bit differently than a Muslim. We don't necessarily believe that everybody in the Bible who wrote down stories about God's action and his impact on humanity and the Israel, you know, the Jews and the New Testament, that they were verbatim writing down God's words. What we believe is that through inspiration, that they conveyed the message from God in their own words. So thus, somebody that has a higher level of Greek, let's say in the New Testament, would have spoken, and you would have noticed that when they wrote it down, that they were more literate and had a better grasp of Greek grammar and, you know, the vocabulary. So that when you read the books, the personality of the author and their background comes out. So for Muslims, I think this is confusing because when they think of inspired, they just think literally dictating. The Bible's dictated to them. And so when you talk about variability of, you know, somebody's language, their background, their education, and how they communicate God's message, to them that seems like it's not God's word anymore, it's the words of the people that are saying it. And in a sense, that's somewhat true in that the personality and the people are using their own words to convey God's message, but the message is inspired, and Christians truly believe the message is from God. It's just that we do see the flavoring of the vehicle that God used to communicate it, whereas Muslims would say that that vehicle really didn't come through in the writing of the Quran. So, that's just something I wanted to mention, and that I've noticed in debates that sometimes that's, you hear these debates going back and forth, and people don't seem to be connecting. And that's part of the reason is that we view the Bible completely differently than the Quran, in at least in some cases. I mean, there is some major differences also in the sense that the Bible was written over a period of about 3,500 years. So, you know, when you look back to the time of the authors writing it, I think Moses, so to speak, back writing the Bible, and to the time, to, you know, when the latest books of the Old Testament were written, you know, you could be talking a couple thousand year period. Well, if you're talking about a couple thousand year period, the vernacular, the analogies and how people even spoke, and, you know, maybe a sense of humor had changed over that period of time. And so the fact is that when you read the Bible, you do have to understand that one part of the Bible, that your, you know, older parts of the Bible were written almost within a different culture than the most current part of the Bible, let's say the New Testament. You do not have that issue with the Quran because it was all written in 23 years. The Quran does not really purport to talk about historical things other than that it does refer back to the Old Testament quite a bit and to somewhat to the New Testament as well. So the Bible itself tells a history of peoples and events that the Bible claims to actually have happened in history, and archaeology shows that. So, as I said, I just wanted to mention that there is a difference in how Muslims and Christians view their holy books, and primarily one is that you know, the Bible is just a much bigger, more complex book written over a much longer period of time. So by its very nature, and also just how we believe that it got written is different in general than how we believe how Muslims believe their book was written. Now, with that said, I want to go into a topic that's on everybody's head and on everybody's mind, and that would be the government shutdown. And when the government shut down that particular night, I remember going to my backyard door and opening it up, and it overlooks a baseball field, and surrounding the baseball field is a bunch of houses. And I yelled, "Oh my God, the government shut down. What am I going to do?" Well, and nothing really happened to me, and for the vast majority of Americans, nothing is happening. That's not to say that it's not impacting some Americans, but for a lot of Americans, you know, in fact, 4 out of 5 Americans report that the government's really not really affecting them, but they know probably somebody that is being affected. So there are people being affected. I want to talk about the polls that have been coming out, and uniformly, if you listen to the media or read a newspaper, if you still do that, but if you're, you know, watching TV or looking on the internet, the polls show the Republicans are taking a beating on this. And here's a sample poll, a typical one that came out just a couple days ago, and this is being reported in the Los Angeles Times. Here's their summary. Only 24% of Americans had a favorable view of Republicans, the lowest figure in the poll's multi-year history. It's not a very long history, by the way, but in the multi-year history, and 4 percentage points lower than last month. And only 21% had a favorable view of the Tea Party. And on the other hand, President Obama's standing was relatively stable, the pollster said, moving from 45% favorable last month to 47% now. Now, that's within the poll's margin of error at 3.5%. Republicans, on the other hand, you know, had an overall favorable of 39%. So, gosh, it looks really bad for the Republicans in Congress there, because the Democrats are doing better, and Obama is not sitting at the same, you know, is nowhere nearly as impacted in terms of negative ratings as the Republicans are right now. Well, the one thing you have to remember is Congress in general is often running around about 20% approval rating. So that's just something to keep in mind there. So when you start talking about a mass or a body of people, it's real easy to have a negative view on it. But the truth is that even with a very, very negative perception of Congress, every year over 90% of congressional candidates get reelected, or congressional incumbents. So the fact that Obama is actually has as negative rating as he does is actually has a bigger impact on him than any individual congressman. It does not translate just because Congress is unpopular or Republicans are unpopular that a Republican's not going to be reelected in his area. That actually, there's a huge body of evidence in history that shows that's not the case. And the other thing I want to mention, though, is that you reading a summary of a poll in a publication a lot of times will not give you the full flavor of the poll. They have a tendency to summarize what they want to summarize, and oftentimes they have an agenda that's not necessarily one that is about being fair and balanced, or one that's favorable toward Republicans. So, for example, this particular poll, which was a NBC Wall Street Journal poll as reported by the LA Times, mentioned the fact that Republicans are really taking a bath. But if you really read deeper into the poll, we could also read that 48% of the population is either neutral or positive about the Republican Party. And another thing that's interesting in the poll, when you read in deeply to the actual poll results itself, John Bonner, the leader of the Republicans in the House, has a 17% total positive, and Harry Reid has an 18% total positive. So the two of the most prominent leaders are basically within the margin of the polls identical. Another thing that was you can find in the poll is that 51% of all those polled believe that Obama is putting his own political agenda ahead of what's good for the nation. Now, that was not covered in the actual LA Times news story. You actually had to get the poll and go through it, which is a rather large PDF file. So one of the things I would encourage you to do is that if you do want to look at polls, actually look at the poll itself and don't just count on the summary of the poll. Further, in the poll, you find out that 37% of the people are very concerned that the Congress will not raise the debt ceiling to pay its bills and are very concerned about that. But so 37% just hold that as to be the most important thing. But 41% are more concerned about raising the debt ceiling and increasing the government debt. So another positive piece of news for the Republicans. So with that said, it is good to look in depth into polls and to actually read the poll results themselves. And sometimes, of course, the wording is very biased as well. We may continue a little bit with some talk about polls when we get back here. But thanks for watching or listening. And this is the Bob Siegel Show. And if you want to call in, you can reach me at 888-344-1170.
Hey, this is Lori K. Lewis, a frequent co-host on The Bob Siegel Show, Talk Radio 1170 on KCBQ. If you have questions or comments during this radio broadcast, please call Bob at this toll-free number, 1-888-344-1170. Again, the number is 1-888-344-1170. We'd like to hear what you have to say.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. This is Mike Friedenberg sitting in for Bob Siegel. And as I mentioned just before that brief, break. If you want to reach the show and join the conversation, you can call in at 888-344-1170. And just to continue with the theme of polls, obviously, you can probably find polls to support your position, but I'm just going to take a look at a major polling organization, CNN, in combination with the ORC polling survey organization. And, you know, interesting, they come to the conclusion that 38% of people feel that Obamacare is a good idea and 43% feel that it's a bad idea. So, and that's actually within the depths of the poll itself by reading into the poll. Further in a poll just done recently by that same organization, 63% of the questioned said they were angry at Republicans, 57% were angry at Democrats, and 53% were angry at President Obama. Once again, I want to stress that being angry at a group of people oftentimes does not translate into anything significant electorally. You can be mad at Congress, but everybody will then re-vote in their own congressman back into Congress because they like their congressman and feel that they're an exception, apparently, to the rest of Congress. Other polls just recently released regarding Obamacare. Less than one in five Americans feel that their families will be better off under the new health care law. So just 20%. Of Americans feel they're going to be positively impacted by the new healthcare law. So that's something that you're not going to hear in general talked about by the mainstream media. But if you do look a little bit further into polls and actually read the actual poll results yourself, you can find some very interesting things. Even if the poll you may believe may not be very particularly conservative, there's always little nuggets in there. So that's enough about polls. Now, I want to completely switch topics right now here. And talk about a subject that I know that you're all thinking about deeply and something you think about before you go to bed at night and worry about. And that is, you know, what's happening to the Star Trek franchise. And I know that, you know, from the government shutdown to the Star Trek franchise, some of you may be going through shock and listen to this, my wonderful transition here. But it's something I've been thinking about because I actually am a fan of Star Trek and have been watching the series as a very young person since the original series came out in the 60s. And lately, there's been a revival, if you're from a particular camp of the Star Trek franchise, with J.J. Abrams' two Star Trek movies, Star Trek and then Star Trek Into the Darkness. And both these movies have been very successful. In fact, I believe that both of them have been more successful than the most popular of the older Star Trek movies. So, you know, that's great. More people being introduced to Star Trek, one could say. However, I would submit that folks that if their introduction to Star Trek is to these movies, they're not really being introduced to Star Trek. And let me explain what I mean. Gene Roddenberry, by the way, who's been dead for quite a few years now, I don't believe we actually would have approved the movies in the form they are, because Gene Roddenberry had a very specific view of what he wanted to accomplish through the Star Trek series. And it was humanistic. Some of it was a little bit silly. For example, in one of the episodes of Next Generation, Picard proclaims that, you know, unlike back in the 21st century, you know, they've eliminated greed and we're no longer worried about money or power. And, you know, that was a statement that he made that was, you know, completely silly, that, you know, somehow 300 or 400 years from now, we'll have passed beyond greed and being concerned about power and, you know, things like that. But getting past that, the Star Trek franchise has always had an air of intellectual air, been more cerebral than, let's say, the Star Wars franchise. You know, science was talked about, even though the science they talked about may or may not be probable, there was always an effort made to make it sound credible, to try to build up a reason for it. Anyway, it was just a much more methodical way of approaching things and more cerebral. And this didn't appeal to everybody. Nonetheless, the Star Trek franchise was very, very popular and successful. Over 200 books, 12 movies, including the two new movies, and and multiple series, you know, starting with the original series, Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, Star Trek Enterprise. I think that's those are the main ones there. Anyway, so there's a huge body, of lore, a huge body worked up throughout the years, 200 books. And what J.J. Abrams did is, through a not-too-clever mechanism, he wiped out all those Star Treks except for Enterprise. So basically, all the events that happened in The Next Generation, all the events that happened in Deep Space Nine, all the events that happened in Voyager, all the events that happened in all the books that used this the real timeline, I'm going to call it the real timeline, that was all destroyed. And in place, we got a new timeline with characters that aren't really even consistent in any intellectual way with the way they would have. Basically, a whole new Star Trek universe that paid lip service to the old Star Trek universe, but in any substantive way is not really paying any kind of real homage to it all. It basically, it instead of being the Star Trek movies that we became used to, where a thoughtful relationship based, we are now have had two Star Trek movies that are typical action movies, well done action movies, great special effects. In fact, I would say that if they didn't have the name Star Trek on them, I might have given the first Star Trek movie a 6 or a 7 and the second one a 7 or 8 out of 10. But when you put the name Star Trek to them, they are not really Star Trek movies. They're what I call, Beverly Hills 90210 meets Star Trek. You know, a lot of pretty people running around firing phasers, doing lots of action, no real rationale. The first Star Trek movie with J.J. Abrams had huge plot holes in it that strained your credulity so that I just really couldn't enjoy it even as an action film. The second movie, which I just recently saw, was actually a much better movie. But once again, I just can't get past the fact that it really is a betrayal of what Gene Roddenberry's vision was. Now, I didn't completely agree with Gene Roddenberry's vision, but it was his vision, and that was where the franchise went. And for just one director and one group of writers, just for money, to completely disrespect that is what I have a problem with. And I'll continue with that line of thought when we get back after this break. And also, we will be talking about the military-industrial complex.
This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539. W&S Electric.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. This is Mike Friedenberg sitting in for Bob Siegel. And just to continue the line of thought here around the Star Trek franchise, why does it really matter? I mean, it's science fiction relative to the important things in the world today. How important is it really? Maybe not that important. But the thing is that it was the brainchild, and the person most responsible for it was a person by the name of Gene Roddenberry. And for him, it wasn't just a matter of making a successful TV show and a successful series of movies and making some money, though he certainly did do very well in that area. But it was his own vision of what he would like mankind to become. As I said, I think I don't necessarily agree with where he was coming from on everything, but that was his vision. And in general, the Star Trek franchise up to that point reflected that. And so to capitalize on the Star Trek name and then to completely, almost completely repudiate that the feel and what he was trying to do through his movies, and I'm repudiate's a little strong, but to really sort of just put it into the background as being not important, I feel that that's just not right. I understand that the need to want to make profit, and these movies did make a lot of profit. I just wish that they could have done so by staying truer to Gene Roddenberry's vision. And but another example of this is the movie Starship Troopers, which was allegedly based on the book Starship Troopers by Robert Heinlein. Well, this is actually even went further and did an even more horrible job, because Heinlein was a graduate of the West Point Military Academy. And if you read his book, he has a very high opinion of military service, a high opinion of the military in general. And the movies, on the other hand, were a parody of the military. There was jackboot thugs looking kind of like Nazis running throughout it. It was a silly movie. And it really, all I can say is it was so blatantly opposite of what Robert Heinlein wanted to convey, is that I really feel that the people that wrote it, the producers, the people that put it together, actually despised Heinlein's views and decided to repudiate them. But the thing was, he was dead. Now, unfortunately, his widow did sell the rights to the story and probably didn't realize what was going to happen to it. And she was an older lady when she did it. I don't really know the situation there. But once again, it's the same. My same objection is that that it's just not the right thing to do, and that to take somebody's work, life's work, and their philosophy, and to, when they're dead, to completely you know, move away from it or disrespect it or ignore it. At the same time benefiting from what they've done, it's just not the right thing to do. So enough on that. As I mentioned, the next area I want to look at, and this is, as you can probably tell, we're covering the Star Trek thing. Certainly Bob Siegel could have covered, and certainly the Muslim thing, but I'm going to talk about something that Bob probably won't be talking about, Bob Siegel, which is the military-industrial complex. And for those who aren't familiar with it, well, it's a term that's not often, you don't often hear out of the mouth of Republicans and conservatives, because more often if you hear about it, it's going to be from some left-wing or liberal organization that's trashing the military, that thinks that all military spending is a waste, and we'll bring up the term military-industrial complex. Well, the term military-industrial complex was first coined by World War II hero and General Eisenhower. And he brought it up in his farewell speech when he left the presidency, and he warned about the rise of the military-industrial complex. And essentially what the military-industrial complex is, it's the defense establishment's what it is. It's the fact that, you know, senior military personnel, officers, move, you know, smoothly move from a career in the military to working for major defense firms. They take all their contacts with them, all their influence for them. So, for example, 300, you know, flag ranks, you know, admirals, generals, so forth and so on, work for some of the major defense firms right now. And so it meshes the military and the defense companies together to be really almost like one entity, which destroys accountability. And the incentives there, the system becomes a bad system, and the incentives there are to maximize revenue to the defense companies. So when you have a system that's set up that has bad incentives, incentives that are promoting behavior that's bad, even if the system's full of great people, you're going to end up with bad results. And that is what we've seen over the last 30 years. We have seen a progressive diminishment of how much we get for our defense dollar in real-time dollars. You know, Congress is bought in. The other part of the military-industrial complex, I should mention, is Congress that receives campaign donations from the defense companies, but they also have these defense companies with, facilities in their districts that they want to keep there. So it's this incestuous relationship between, you know, Congress, between the military and the defense companies, and it is completely, really almost completely destroyed accountability. You know, you hear, you know, people complaining about it and investigations go on, but the bottom line is these investigations have not substantially hurt any of the defense companies. And it creates an environment that really, that just makes it almost impossible for a whistleblower to do so, especially somebody in the military, and not tremendously damage their career or end their career in the military. You know, for example, let's say you're a lieutenant who happens to be working as a liaison on developing the advanced gun system, which is a system that's was mounted on the DDX-1000 and cost hundreds of millions of dollars to develop. And you begin to question, really, if this is a good way to spend taxpayer money. Well, who are you going to go to talk about it? Well, you could talk to your immediate person above you in the chain of command, and they'll tell you, well, this has already been approved by everybody, and everybody else seems to think it's good. And by the way, General so-and-so has testified, or Admiral so-and-so has testified before Congress just how wonderful this system is. Okay. So you can see that if he is going to bypass chain of command to point out some issues with this, that the impact on his career could be very severe. Not only would it be severe within the military, he's not going to advance any further. It's going to be the end of him there. But when he gets out of the military, the defense companies aren't going to want to hire him. And he'll be a persona non grata. There is no incentives in the military to create accountability right now. And so we have an example of, for example, the new bomber that's supposed to be heavy bomber supposed to replace the B-52. It's going to cost $670 million per bomber. That's craziness. But yet Congress's abide has bought into that. The F-22 Raptor, depending on how you cost it, but the full life cycle cost is up to $370 million per plane. We can't afford to buy that type of equipment. We just can't afford anymore. So what we're happening is, even though we're spending nearly as much as we did in inflation-adjusted dollars during the Reagan years, for example, the 600-ship Navy under John Lehman and Ronald Reagan, even though we're spending almost that much in inflation-adjusted dollars, we now have a Navy that's got 263 ships, maybe, that are falling apart. Accidents are happening. The maintenance is not being done. In fact, Admiral Greener just recently deferred $500 million worth of maintenance, which will lead to further accidents and problems. And why did he defer that? So that we could spend more money on new ships and new things that would keep the money flowing to the defense contractors. I mean, it's a may sound very bad, and I'm sure that the people involved with this have good reasons to why they're doing it, and it is more complex than I'm describing, but ultimately the overarching explanation that gives the most explanation for the way we see money being spent is that the currently defense spending and procurement is optimized to maximize the flow of money into the defense contractors. And there's a lot of ways it's done, a lot of ways that it's done. For example, minimal crewing, or what they called optimal crewing. That was an experiment that is, hopefully they recognize this failed miserably, of reducing the crew on Navy ships to really what's been found to be unsafe levels. But by doing that, the operational costs of the ships were reduced and more money was available to buy new technology and new equipment. Automation. The military has been talking about automation and automated fire systems in particular. And the idea is that if we automate things, that we can build ships that require less people, and the life cycle costs on those ships will be less, which means we can spend a lot more money on the ship up front. Of course, the technology has not been validated, and the automation comes nowhere close to replacing the men on the ships. It does replace some of the fire stuff, but as far as things like, you know, shoring up the damage from a hole, 90% of what you would be doing trying to keep a ship alive needs bodies and men to do it, and this automation can't do it. So, but by including a lot of automation and reducing the crew size, the life cycle cost of the ship is reduced. So instead of being willing to spend $1 million on a ship, they can say, well, the ship costs $2 million. Ship costs $2 million. But don't worry about that because we've reduced the crew size on it. It's the same as if you were to buy a ship that cost $1 million but had more crew members. And it goes on and on and on, and these sorts of things that are going on right now with our spending, such that we, as you say, we are getting far less for our dollar than we used to get. We'll continue this discussion when we get back. And once again, this is the Bob Siegel Show, and Mike Friedenberg sitting for Bob Siegel. And if you do want to reach the show, 888-344-1170.
Do your kids ask you questions about God and the Bible that you can't answer? Sign yourself or your child up for a class with lots of solid answers at educateforlife.org before someone else gives them the wrong answers. Are you tired of not knowing what to say when your friends and family ask you questions about God and the Bible? Get equipped by signing up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone asks you, "How do you know the Bible's true?" do you say something like, "I just know it is"? If you're tired of giving lame answers, sign up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone says that God isn't real, wouldn't it be fun to prove that He is? Quickly, like a verbal ninja? By using science and logic. Sign up for a class at educateforlife.org with Christian apologetics teacher Kevin Conover, and you'll learn how to do that. Educateforlife.org.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. This is Mike Friedenberg, and continuing our discussion on how we're spending our defense dollars, let me back up for a second and just say that I, as many people that are conservatives, truly believe that the military is essential, that a strong military is essential, and that if anything, if the government should be doing anything, that having a strong military is one of the things you should be doing. So I'm not coming from the perspective that we need to reduce spending on the military. I might even be willing to support an increase in military spending based upon the idea that, military spending as a percentage of our GDP is, the lowest in recent years. It's dropped dramatically to, pre-World War II, type averages. But with that said, just dumping money into a system that's broken, I don't think that's a very conservative position. And we will not get the mix of weapon systems that we need to most effectively, carry out our national interest. And also, and just as importantly, to make sure that, the sailors and the soldiers are best equipped to win a war with a minimum, loss. And right now, I do not believe that we are actually doing that right now. And the system is broken. In 2009, the Government Accountability Office released a study of 96 major defense acquisition programs, and it found that almost two-thirds of them suffered major cost overruns, 40% above contract prices, and these cost overruns came to nearly $300 billion. But see, that is really just the tip of the iceberg. That's just the top 96 programs, but also that also just assumes that the initial cost that was being estimated was a reasonable cost. And that is something that's very, very doubtful as well. In general, when these contracts are done, the defense contractors are trying to justify the largest possible, cost for the program with the minimal amount of responsibility and accountability. So regardless, it was $300 billion. And when we look at the Kermit process, there's some key factors that have contributed to this, and all these play into the hands of optimizing the system for more money into the hands of defense contractors for less accountability and less actual systems and weapons really being built or delivered. An over-reliance on a revolutionary approach to design and development versus an evolutionary approach. So a revolutionary new design sounds great. Let's take a look at the F-22 Raptor. The F-22 Raptor is the most complex, most sophisticated fighter plane in the world. Costs hundreds and hundreds of millions of billions of dollars to develop. Each unit is somewhere between, depending on how you want to cost, somewhere between 150 to 370 million, depending whether you look at just the the incremental cost or the life cycle cost, but it was meant to be revolutionary, but it's not going to be used in the near future. So one of the things we found throughout history is that revolutionary military achievement that's not used rapidly loses its revolutionary advantage. For example, if we were to release the F-22 and immediately use it in a battle, that's great. But once we release the F-22, it's going to be sitting out there for, it could be decades, and it's not going to be revolutionary anymore. Much of the technology has already leaked over to the Chinese. The actual geometry of the plane, which was optimized to provide the maximum stealth while still providing for, being able to cruise at supersonic, while providing for being able to still be maneuverable. Well, once that plane started flying, that geometric design, which hundreds of millions of dollars took to develop, became available to anybody they wanted. The Chinese, the Russians, that all became available to them. So a revolutionary weapon system, unless it's used, does not stay revolutionary very long. Now, the other problem with the F-22, we're using that as an example, was that they wanted to be the best at everything. And when you try to design something to be the best at everything, it's usually almost impossible from an engineering perspective. So in the case of the F-22 Raptor, they wanted to have very high supersonic speed, supersonic cruise capabilities. They wanted it to also to be the stealthiest plane ever developed, and it is very stealthy for certain types of radar. And they also wanted to be able to win in dogfights. Well, that's quite a tall order. And recently, in combat exercises, against the Eurofighter, which cost a fraction of the F-22, they found the Eurofighter actually matching the F-22 in terms of dogfighting capabilities. So a plane far less than the F-22 could match dogfighting capabilities. That's not surprising. When you try to be the best at everything, you start to have your engineering goals start to conflict with each other. For example, is stealth a stealth design, a high stealth design? Is that really the best design for having a really fast super cruise capability for supersonic super cruise capability? Is that really the best design to give you the best maneuverability for a dogfight? Well, intuitively, we know that that's not the case. So we spent a lot of money there to design an airplane that, at the time it came out, is revolutionary. Of course, along with that, we found out that the plane was highly unreliable, and we're still trying to get this plane to the point where it's reliable enough to, give us acceptable availability rates. So it was incredibly unreliable when it was first released. We've also seen that, but it cost a lot of money to develop. Lots of money went to R&D, and all that money was continually flowing into the hands of defense contractors. So, from their point of view, it was a success. One of the things that is a big problem is to have Congress and the military hierarchy sign off on technology that incorporates immature or non-existent technology design. So if you incorporate a non-existent technology into a future design or immature technology into a design, you're basically giving carte blanche to the folks that are developing this to have cost overruns and have a ready-made excuse. Because after all, how can you expect them to come in on budget for something that's not even really doesn't exist yet? And we've done this time and time again, where we've gone ahead and signed off on projects that incorporate large numbers of new technologies that don't even exist. And then lo and behold, they go over by 200% or 300% over the budget. And that was predictable. Anytime you do that, you're going to have a cost overrun. So that's part of the list here. And we will continue with some of the characteristics we've seen in our defense procurement and contracting over the last 20 or 30 years when we get back. And once again, this is the Bob Siegel Show. Mike Friedenberg sitting in for Bob, and we'll be back in just a minute or so.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's weekly column for Washington Times Communities. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net, S-I-E-G-E-L, bobsiegel.net. Here, you can download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. This is Mike Friedenberg sitting in for Bob Siegel. And we were discussing military-industrial complex and the current procurement process, which is far from, far from efficient and far from cost-effective and far from delivering the value we should expect as taxpayers and what we want for our military men and women. So I was talking about a few of the factors that have contributed to continual cost overruns, continually contributing to systems that end up, you know, with extremely long, long life cycles before they ever hit the actual, battlefield, and have troubles with reliability just because of the number of immature or non-existent technology that have been incorporated into them that have become existent through a tremendous expenditure of money. And going back once again is that if these systems are not used and just sit around, in training exercises, That technology that we spend billions to create finds its way into the hands of our enemies or potential opponents. And so what we really find is that, you know, for example, the Chinese are able to implement for millions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars what it took us billions of dollars to do because of the technology leakage that's, you know, shifting over there. In fact, a recent study found that that the amount of technology that has flowed into the Chinese hands from the United States has allowed them to jump ahead 25 years. So these long, long life cycles that never end with revolutionary technology do not give us the best mix, the most powerful mix of weapon systems into the battlefield. What they do is they give us less of the weapon systems that may not be as reliable, but they are technically advanced. An example of this is the Zumwalt destroyer, the DDX-1000. Now, the story of the Zumwalt destroyer begins in 1992 when the last of the battleships, the Missouri, was decommissioned. As you may recall, the four battleships, the Iowa, the Missouri, the New Jersey, and the Wisconsin, were reactivated in the Gulf War during the buildup of the 600-ship Navy. They were reactivated and modernized, and their key role, besides providing a presence, and they could fire missiles just like our missile cruisers today, was to provide naval surface gunfire support. So if you want to land Marines or soldiers and you want to have the enemy keep its heads down, there was nothing better than a battleship to do that. The Navy did not want to keep the battleships going, and there's a variety of reasons for it. Part of it was by retiring the battleships, they freed up space to buy new ships. And also, they promised the Marines in 1992, the Marines were very upset about the decommissioning of the battleships, that they would develop a replacement for the battleship. Okay, so 20 years later and $22 billion, we ended up with, and there's quite a story behind it, but we ended up with something called the DDX-1000 Zumwalt Destroyer. This is a 14,000-ton ship, carries a bunch of missiles, just like our Burkes do, the Arleigh Burke destroyer does, just like the Ticonderoga missile cruiser does, just like some of our submarines carry. So that capability itself is something we didn't really need, but it also has a 155-millimeter advanced gun system. That's two guns of 155 millimeters each. Each one of these ships costs $7 billion each, and they were supposed to be replacing the battleship. Of course, the battleship has nine 408-millimeter guns and like 12 5-inch guns, and these ships have just a teeny fraction of the firepower of a battleship. It's that this is the result of a $22 billion process is just craziness. They fire shells, 155-millimeter shells, that cost $40,000 to $50,000 each with the same payload as the normal 155-millimeter shell, which cost about $400 each. So this was our great technological advancement. The idea was, though, that these shells would be very highly accurate, and it could provide fire support for our troops as they're storming the beaches or moving inland. Unfortunately, after they built these ships, the Navy said, well, I guess these ships are too fragile to survive in an area this close to the shore, known as the littoral area. So we're now going to use them as technology demonstration platforms because they're not very survivable for the role they were allegedly designed for. Of course, they're very stealthy. They have a new hull design. For blue water, their stealthiness might be an advantage, but once you get into littoral waters and you open fire, any stealthiness disappears. A ship that is maintaining high volumes of fire support is no longer a stealthy ship. This is something that anybody could have thought of 20 years ago, yet we still ended up with these three technology demonstration platforms and $22 billion. That money could have been kept the battleships operating. And in fact, when I started looking into procurement, that was one of my rationales. There's actually two ships available for reactivation. They're called mobilization assets. In the case of emergency, they can't still be reactivated. That's a little known fact. Even though they are sitting there, in Long Beach, and is one of them, and I think the other one may be in Oregon, these ships can actually be reactivated. So we have that situation there where the ship with this 155-millimeter, dual 155-millimeter guns was created out of a $22 billion process. It was the advanced gun system. That's what they call it. And if you take a look at this, you wonder how anybody ever signed off on it. It's an incredibly complex, several hundred tons per magazine. And the magazine is designed to be automated so that automatically will load up these 155-millimeter shells, which actually look more like little missiles, and do it in an automated fashion. That way they can reduce crew size. So this 14,000-ton ship has a crew of about 140 people. And that's supposed to be exciting because by reducing crew size, the cost of operating the ship is cheaper. But in no way does a 14,000-ton ship with 140 crew members have enough people to really go into battle and take damage. 140 people, that absolutely is not enough to effectively do damage on that ship, and is not enough to even really be resilient enough to take casualty losses. The only way that 140-person ship that's 14,000 tons can operate is in a peacetime situation where it's not taking hits. So this was a complete bust, and is an example of the kind of stuff we've been getting out of the procurement process. High-tech, revolutionary technology, reducing operational costs in order to maximize the amount of capital costs that could be spent so that more money can flow into the hands of the contractors. Now, there is more complexity to it than that, but really, another example of this is a littoral combat ship, originally designed to be a cheap, fast ship that could come in and fire missiles at enemy targets, both at land and sea, and then run away. Originally going to be about $250 million. Currently, the cost is $750 million. And in order to save money, the Navy now decided to build them to commercial specifications, not military specifications. And they further decided that these ships can no longer operate in dangerous waters. So, and yet we're still plunging ahead with building these LCS ships, which, by the way, the nickname among Navy personnel, enlisted in some officers, is little crappy ships. Now, they're not that little, but the bottom line is for the amount of money and their size, they're underpowered. They don't have much firepower compared to other ships from other navies around the world, including allied navies. But they are the result of this process, which maximized the flow to the defense contractors. As I said, now, just optimizing the flow to defense contractors is not the only thing that's been driving this. Some other things have been driving some of the decisions being made, but I would say that's the number one. Other factors include a belief, and I think it's a bad belief, that the kind of domination that we saw in Gulf War I and Gulf War II in battlefield intelligence and command, control, communications, and computers will be maintained in the future. And that is just a very bad way to move forward with in how you design your force structure. Because assuming that your ships aren't going to be hit, and that the enemy will never be able to hit your ships, and designing them that way is, I think, is irresponsible. So, anyway, that's pretty much all we have time for today. But I would encourage you to take a look and really just pay a little more attention to how we're spending our money, because I'm sure a lot of people that do, listen to the show, really strong support a strong military, and we do want to deliver the ships, the weapon systems, the tanks, you know, the guns that our soldiers and sailors need to do the best job. And right now, the military and the procurement process is not doing that. Anyway, we thank you for listening to The Bob Siegel Show. Mike Friedenberg sitting in for Bob Siegel, and have a nice evening.
The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.